It's Storylines Midwest. I'm Keith Taylor.
And I'm Charity Nebbe. In upcoming Storylines Midwest programs, we'll be exploring some of the other great literature of the Midwest and how it reflects our lives today, including the legendary environmental writings of Aldo Leopold in a Sand County Almanac. And also Joyce Carol Oates will be with us to talk about her novel Them and the Detroit Race Riots of 1967.
But today we're talking about Ernest Hemingway's Nick Adams stories, which of course include the famous Big Two-Hearted River, which takes place after Nick Adams, or maybe even Ernest Hemingway, returns damaged in some unspecified way from World War I. Here's Scott Simon reading an excerpt.
The train went up on the track out of sight to round one of the hills of burnt timber. Nick sat down on the bundle of canvas and bedding the baggage man had pitched out of the door of the baggage car. There was no town, nothing but the rails and the burned-over country. The 13 saloons that had lined the one street of Seney had not left a trace. The foundations of the Mansion House Hotel stuck up above the ground. The stone was chipped and split by the fire. It was all that was left of the town of Seney. Even the surface had been burned, off the ground. Nick looked at the burned-over stretch of hillside where he'd expected to find the scattered houses of the town and then walked down the railroad track to the bridge over the river. The river was there. It swirled against the log spiles of the bridge. Nick looked down into the clear, brown water colored from the pebbly bottom and watched the trout keeping themselves steady in the current with wavering fins. As he watched them, they changed their positions by quick angles, only to hold steady in the fast water again. Nick watched them a long time.
We're talking today about the Nick Adams stories of Ernest Hemingway with James McCullough, an English teacher at North Central Michigan College, and Jerry Dennis, a Northern Michigan writer. If you'd like to join our conversation with your stories of life up north or your impressions of Nick Adams and Ernest Hemingway, give us a call at 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. Now, Jerry, you've actually fished the river that Ernest Hemingway is writing about in this story, right?
And it's not the Two-Hearted. Of course, most people know that now. When I was in college, it was still being debated. There were still scholars who took it for granted that it was the Two-Hearted River that he was writing about. But any of us who knew the river knew that he couldn't have hiked to the Two-Hearted in one day from Seney. So it had to be the Fox River. So we had a little cult that was kind of smug in our knowledge, and we would go fish the Fox and feel Ernie's ghost in the presence of the river.
But there really is a big Two-Hearted River, though, right?
Yes. It's not the big. It's just Two-Hearted. And, yeah, it's about 40 miles north of the Fox. And the river he describes doesn't sound much like the Fox. It sounds more like the Sturgeon River down by Petoskey. It's a riffle and pool river with gravel bottom. The Fox is slower, tag alder lined through a lot of it. Sand bottom, yeah. And unless it was the east branch of the Fox, which has been discussed as a possibility. But, I think it's obvious that it didn't really matter. He was trying to create a sense, an illusion of reality a lot more than he was interested in being true to the facts.
And later he admitted that he liked the title Big Two-Hearted because it was poetry.
Yeah. It's a beautiful name. It is a beautiful name, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was it like for you fishing on the Fox River?
Well, the first time I went, it didn't turn out too well. I my car broke down on the way there, so I had to hitchhike. And then when I got there, it had rained real hard the day before. And when I got there, it was a summer afternoon, very muggy, and the mosquitoes came. And I have never seen mosquitoes like that. I mean, you couldn't breathe. They would fill my nostrils if I tried to breathe without covering my face. And so I never even fished the first time. I just ran, got back out on the highway.
It's interesting because my first time fishing the Fox was with my dad, and I was not there at mosquito season. I was there at black fly season. And I did my standard bug dope application on my face and arms and so on. And when we finished the day, I took my hat off and I had bites all along the rim of my hat. took my shirt off and I had bites all along the rims of my shirt, inside my shirt, and they had gone up my pants and bitten all along the tops of my socks. So I was
I was
absolutely chewed.
Maybe this is why people don't go to Northern Michigan to follow.
That would be one reason why. That would be one significant reason why.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. And Chuck is on the line in East Lansing, Michigan. Hello, Chuck.
Yes.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, one of the professors was talking about how Ernest would be bored and sitting at town meetings. And that fits in with my family recollection of Ernest in those days. My grandfather was the milkman for Walloon Lake.
Oh, wow.
And Ernest, he was not a real literary man, but he the only thing I ever heard him say about Ernest was that he would come out and ride along on his milk route because that got him out of Windermere, which was a house full of women. And he just had to get out at times. And my grandfather mostly remembered him as kind of a bored kid. This, of course, was prior to the First World War.
Yeah.
Right. At that point, by the time he was 17 or so, he pitched a tent outside the cabin and spent most of the summer outside of the cabin.
Get it so he could get away from his mother and his sisters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there was a lot of work. They expected him to pitch in and do a lot of the physical work, and he wasn't crazy about that.
He'd rather go fishing.
No, he wasn't. Yeah. Exactly. I think so. Yeah.
Well, Chuck, thank you so much for your call and your story. Next up, we have Tom in Utica, Michigan. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
How are you this evening?
Fine. How are you?
Good.
I've got a question for Jerry, please.
Sure.
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, you know, for ages, critics were saying that a whole generation of writers grew up imitating Hemingway, and I believe you're young enough to be like the generation after that, so I assume you don't emulate Hemingway. But I was just thinking, in terms of his nonfiction, wow, what kind of challenges would you face if you were to try to emulate his style with your outdoor writing in 2001?
Well, there's always the challenge of trying to lie like he did. You know, some of the stories he wrote for the Toronto newspaper were, you know, like fishing in the St. Mary's River for rainbow trout. He never even went there, but he gave a very strong impression that he did. But are you talking more like stylistically?
Well, you know, like he talks about that 300-yard shot he made on an antelope and the bravado. You know, is that style or is that substance, I guess?
I think writers can't get away with that anymore. Readers are too sophisticated. I think it used to be a lot more possible to exaggerate, make yourself the hero of the story. He got away with it. I don't think writers for the outdoor press today can get away with it.
All right.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tom. It's good to hear from you. I'd like to hear another excerpt now from The Last Good Country. This is that long piece that was unpublished during Hemingway's lifetime. This is a part where Nick and his little sister, who he calls Littlest in this story, leave the logged-over area outside Petoskey and enter some of the last remaining virgin forest.
They came from the hot sun of the slashings into the shade of the great trees. The slashings had run up to the top of a ridge and over, and then the forest began. They were walking on the brown forest floor now, and it was springy and cool under their feet. There was no underbrush, and the trunks of the trees rose 60 feet high before there were any branches. It was cool in the shade of the trees, and high up in them Nick could hear the breeze, and that was rising. No sun came through as they walked, and Nick knew there would be no sun through the high-top branches until nearly noon. His sister put her hand in his and walked close to him.
You know, just this past summer, my husband and I were up by Copper Harbor, and we went to the Estevant Pines, which is a small tract of virgin forest up there. James, around Petoskey, is there any virgin forest left?
I would say no. I think some of the closest virgin forest would be on South Manitou Island. There's a little corner of cedars on that island called the Valley of the Giants, where somehow the loggers missed a few of them. And evidently those, not evidently, I've seen them, those cedars are 16 feet in diameter. And there's also the Hartwick Pines, you know, down by Frederick, just north of Grayling, where people can stop and see old growth trees, but you don't see them. Most of the entire state was logged over. So they didn't miss a tree, really. and it changed the landscape forever. I mean, there were times around in the late 1800s where, you know, the elk moved in, prairie chickens, all kinds of prairie animals popped up in Michigan because they had leveled the place.
So when people like us, downstaters like us, Southerners, when we come up north, we might think we're looking for a wild experience or something. You guys might wish we stayed home. I don't know, but what are we going to find when we go up there?
Well, it's second and third growth forest now, and a lot of it is old enough that it is still wild. It's grown up. You know, in Hemingway's day, most of the landscape was denuded. He would look across hills that were bare. It was just slashings. And it's grown up a lot since then. There's selective logging going on, and then occasional patches of clear cutting. But most of our forests now are pretty mature hardwoods. We won't see the virgin pines ever again. Those days are long gone. But we have patches of pine and hemlock mixed in with the hardwoods, and the trees are a foot to two feet in diameter, and they're big, and they're interlocked across the top, and it's shaded underneath, and they're beautiful for us. They're gorgeous. I think Hemingway would have appreciated them.
They're patchworks, though, of course. Much of the forest is managed. There's a real industry in Michigan that the DNR manages in terms of harvesting large sections of trees, particularly poplars. But there are also organizations that are trying to maintain a kind of wilderness pathway so that there are links between the old forests and so that there is some kind of continuity.
Well, when Hemingway wrote in that story about going through the virgin forest, he talked a lot about how solemn it felt, how different it felt from
religious,
the land now.
He said,
really,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly, a religious experience. Can you describe what it was like for you to go into virgin forest?
Oh, well, I was very lucky. I grew up on the edge of town in Petoskey, and my parents' house is next to a bird sanctuary that's next to the winter sports park that's next to the Bayview Woods. So as a kid, I would run our English setters back there and really feel alone, solitude. And so in that way, the experiences that he describes Nick Adams having in solitude in the sense of spirituality in the wilderness, I really was able to have. I remember my dad always saying that it's becoming more and more difficult to escape the internal combustion engine. That's what he would say. Yeah. And at that time when I was a kid, I mean, if a plane flew over, it was kind of a big deal. I mean, we'd say a plane. but now if you're even on the river, you know, even fishing, I like to fish particular rivers, and there's one that dumps into a lake not too far from me that I fish quite frequently, and I can hear jet skis out there, and I can hear I can hear the semis going down the road a mile and a half away, and really that experience of real solitude and quiet is very difficult to have now.
I just like to add, in the stand at Hartwick Pines, which is fairly sizable, those trees were never logged. They are original virgin pines, and they're very large. They're very tall. You get a feel of what it must have been like up until about the 1880s when the logging really got going. you can see for a long ways through those woods. There's no undergrowth because the trees are so thick in the in their tops that not enough sunlight gets through. The the ground is carpeted with pine needles, very thick. I mean, it's it's a cushion. You could take a wonderful nap on them. And the wind in the pines is a beautiful, soothing sound. Hemingway was enough of an imaginator to know what it must have been like. And he used that image in several of the stories, both in The Last Good Country especially and in Big Two-Hearted River. And I think he wanted to give the impression that it was like a cathedral and was sanctuary. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it was. That's the feeling I got at Hartwick Pines.
And definitely. I think that feeling is still possible. I feel it, but you have to go. You have to really seek it out, and you can still have that in northern Michigan, but I think you have to seek it out.
Do you think that sense of the solemn, that sort of spiritual renewal that so many of us feel when we go into a really truly wilderness area? Do you think that's what so many of us are looking for when we head up north?
Well, I know that a lot of people do, but I know also that. The changes that are referred to, Petoskey changing so much, with the advent of subdivisions and well, really a whole town in Bay Harbor, I don't know that the people who are coming up north have enough experience or with the wilderness or have an appreciation of the wilderness that I think we're discussing here. I think what they're doing in a lot of ways is they're bringing the culture that they are, I think, trying to leave with them and developing the countryside in a way that may endanger future generations from having the kinds of experiences that Jerry and I were lucky to have as children.
You're listening to Storylines America. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 866-255-2762. Right now, we have a question from Dave in Traverse City, or a comment. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. What do you have to tell us?
Well, I had a question about suicide, actually. It's a little far afield from what we've been talking about heretofore, but I was just curious what your panel's opinion was. Hemingway, from my understanding, took his life when it became clear that he could no longer... his mind didn't function the way it used to, and I'm curious what the panel's opinion of that is. Is suicide justified?
Wow. Jerry or James, do you want to go there?
I've thought about it quite a bit.
About Hemingway's suicide?
About his particular... Yeah, right. Yeah, let's clarify that. I've thought about his suicide quite a bit. I think most people would agree that he was bipolar, that he had a pre-existing, inherited genetic difficulty, and that he you could see that in the pattern of his work. I think more recent research has shown also that he not only had a genetic predisposition to this sort of manic depressive cycle, but he also drank heavily, which doesn't help. Mm-hmm. He was taking pretty much a soup of chemicals toward the end, including Ritalin and some sort of testosterone booster and some antidepressant. And I think this chemical soup that he was taking also was complicating things, and his self-image as somebody who could continue to produce.
And his father was a suicide too, wasn't he?
And there was suicide all over. His first wife's Hadley's father committed suicide. His father committed suicide. He'd thought about suicide from an early age. You can see it in the Nick Adams stories.
Yeah,
Nick Adams as a young boy is asking the father about suicide. One of the Indians commits suicide when his wife has trouble with a childbirth, and so this is something that was on his mind from an early age. Yeah. And I think all of those issues coming together really put him in a position where it was likely to happen. And his family members also, one of his sisters and his younger brother also committed suicide.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for your call. It's a different side of Hemingway, the Hemingway we've been talking about today. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. 855-2762. And Kathy is on the line from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hello, Kathy.
Hello.
And you grew up on Walloon Lake?
Yes, I grew up on the other side of the lake, directly across from where Windermere is located.
Ah.
And I guess I would like the panel to go back to an earlier area that we've been discussing throughout the show, but it seemed like there was a kind of a stark contrast being drawn between Hemingway, who left the area, who really didn't stay in one place, and the panel was making a contrast between Hemingway and almost themselves as being set put, or they had set put their roots down. And I find we go up north quite a bit, and I find that it's a hard time right now to be going up north because of the changes. And I guess I would like the panel to comment on kind of the hopelessness, in a way, from Hemingway versus it almost seems like they have hope. And I guess I'd like for them to comment on that.
You liked them to convey some hope as well. I get the impression, Kathy.
Well, I think there's lots of reasons for hope. A lot of people are committed to protecting what remains of the woods and of keeping the rivers and lakes clean and healthy. And I've traveled quite a lot around the world studying rivers and ecosystems, and they're still in very good shape here. Our rivers are some of the healthiest, prettiest, cleanest rivers in the United States, and definitely east of the Mississippi. I think James and I both feel a pretty strong commitment to staying here. Our family roots are part of it, but it's also a place where we want to raise our children, and we want them to have the option of staying if they choose to, because the rivers are still clean and the woods are still, you know, it's still possible to find places to be alone, and there's even a few places where you can get lost. So yes, we're working at it. We're committed to protecting and sort of nurturing what's left of it.
That doesn't mean that there aren't times when you feel great despair and rage and all of those things about what's happening and what has happened. I mean, many of the places that were so tied in my childhood memory to personal events have been destroyed or ruined or plowed over, and it disorients a person. But I agree with Jerry. The only position that you can have is that there's hope, because that's what will ensure what's left for the future.
Otherwise, it's despair.
Yeah, and I don't think despair gets you anywhere.
Right. We have another call here. Paul has been very patient from Birmingham, Michigan. He's been waiting. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how are you guys?
Doing well. How are you?
Hey, hi, Paul.
Well, I'm hoping that Nextel is going to keep in line with us here and keep a connection.
Okay. So, what do you want to tell us, Paul?
Well, I grew up in all the area that indeed we're talking about now, and probably never had as great an appreciation as I should have. But my great-great-grandfather Garfield had a farm at the same end where the Hemingways were, but really never made that kind of connection really until now.
Huh.
But kind of my point is, holy mackerel, how much history do all the people that really grew up there, and since the late 60s and 70s, spending all my summers and all my time up there in that area, how much have we really missed and forgotten, or really have never spent the time to learn? And holy mackerel, again, the same thing. What did we miss? And now we really understand how much Hemingway, you know, how important that was.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
All the details that we missed. But
yeah, Jerry and James, I mean, do you think somebody up there, people up there, preserving that these days? Are they trying to get these oral histories and family histories down?
Oh, I think so, and I certainly would hope to, as a teacher, be involved in projects that. We'll capture some of these great stories. One is proposed right now with our Friendship Center. Friendship Center is an organization in Petoskey that looks after our elderly, and we're looking at a looking for grant money to start a project that would have creative writing students recording the histories that have been videotaped with some of our senior citizens. And I'd like to try to get that going in the fall, actually.
Well, this is a big question for both of you, and I don't know which one of you wants to tackle this first, but what do you think you've learned from your time in the wilderness?
Oh, wow.
That is a big question.
You want to go? Well, we both take breaths at the same time, so I'm going to let Jerry go.
Okay.
There's so many things. It's life-changing to be in the wilderness. I mean, the true wilderness. We don't really have any wilderness left in the lower peninsula of Michigan. We have some pretty good-sized chunks of woods, but it's hard to find many places where you can go more than a mile or two before you run into at least a dirt road. The Upper Peninsula is better. There's some places where you can go 15 or 20 miles. You learn, you know, Hemingway valued so many things that he learned from the woods, and I think a lot of that's still valid. He wrote somewhere that all the things that mattered to him he'd learned in the woods, like loyalty, honor, nobility, courage, self-reliance, duty. Those things are all, you know, they all come from having to take care of yourself when you're out, you know, far away from help. I mean, and those are things you learn, you know. Hopefully you can learn them from a parent or somebody older. But you also, I think, what I get from it more is remembering the value of silence and quiet, and it caused me to slow down into. I always have those ahas. I go, oh yeah, this is what I've been missing. This is why it's been so stressful at home, because I haven't taken the time to slow down and pay attention. I don't think of it in spiritual terms. I think of it as more psychological. Than you calm down, you quiet down, you slow down. And then you start noticing the world, and suddenly life is really rich again.
Great. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you both so much for being with us today. We're out of time, so I'm sorry we're going to miss your answer,
That's
James.
Okay.
But thank
That's
you
okay.
very
thank
much
you.
For being here. James McCullough teaches English at North Central Michigan College and is director of the Bear River Writers Conference. Jerry Dennis is a Northern Michigan writer. He's published several collections of essays about nature, including A Place on the Water and Angler's Reflections on Home. For more information on Storylines Midwest or the books we're reading, you can visit our website at storylines.ala.org, or you can go to your local public library. Participating libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and they also have discussion guides available. You're listening to Storylines Midwest.
Storylines Midwest is produced by Tamar Charney. Our engineer is Bob Skahn.
We had production help from Rebecca Williams, Michelle Bolick, Amanda McWhorter, and Allison Zatorski.
Today's readings were performed by Scott Simon.
Our library discussion guides were written by David Long. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries.
The executive producer of the Storylines America Project is Paul Zales.
Storylines Midwest comes to you from the studios of Michigan Radio at the University of Michigan. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Keith Taylor.
Storylines Midwest is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and Barnes & Noble Booksellers.
In the early 20th century, millions of African Americans moved north for jobs in the new factories and for a better life away from the Jim Crow South. Here, they found a different kind of prejudice.
Richard Wright's Native Son and the Effects of a Divided Society. Next time on Storylines Midwest.